freely introduce themselves.
And I have a few on the show of the panel. There's one thing that I thought of when I was having my cup of tea that I should have mentioned earlier. Before, both in correspondence and on the first day of hearing about the potential for the Renaka to have a reply, I was conferring with my colleagues before we started today, and where we got to at the moment is that we would like obviously, you at the end of Renaka presentation, you may well want to make an application for leave to reply on specific issues, and I already said that I'll be receptive to that, provided it's targeted. Mm. I don't want to give you a general right of reply,
no.
Because that's going to raise natural justice issues for all of the other parties. But for panel, would like to take a little bit of time following the end of the Renaka case to see if we identify something, if further issues or documentation or mapping or all of the above that the Renaka could assist us with. So what I'll probably do at the end of the Renaka case is probably adjourn for half an hour for us to confer and then come back and talk to you about that. The answer may be that there's nothing, but if there's something, then we can talk about it and talk about ways and means and times and things like that. And similarly, you could spend that half hour deciding whether there's anything else, anything you particularly want to reply on as well.
Well, I'm grateful for the heads up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yeah. How do you want to proceed? You have three groups.
I think I'll just hand the floor over.
There's a little bit of a wise man.
Yep.
Kia ora tātou. Ko kā te huikati nā mō e te rapu wai me waitaha ngā iwi. Ko kā te huirapa ki Pukitaraki i tōku Runaka. Ko kā te hawe e kā te rua hikihiki me kā te huirapa oku hapu. Tōku whānau, ko Waibara, ko Parata, nō te rohi o Waitaki, o Tāwa Waitaki, kei raro ki te Taitoka, kei Motopohu. Ko Linkata tōku ingoa, nō reira mihi atu ki a koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. So, my name's Lynn Carter, or Lynette Carter, and I'm from Pukitaraki Runaka, which is one of the reasons I'm here. I was also in the room, so to speak, for several of the sessions with my kaumātua, Matapura Allison. I also was a lecturer at the University of Otago, and one of my key research areas for the past 20 years has been looking at issues of landscape and identity, and in particular, the politics of place naming. I was asked to present some evidence around the politics of place naming and around the academic evidence, if you like, of the relevance and significance of our wāhi tūpuna names. Kia ora tātou.
Kia ora tātou. Ka hui hui mai tātou katoa, tēnā koutou. Tēnā koutou. Ko Takapō te roto, te kohurau te monka. Ko Waitaki te awatapu, ko te tai wara i tūru te mōna. Ko te rapu wai ko Waitaha, ko Kāti Māmoe mai kaitahu te iwi. Ko te autau mārewa, ko Kāti Huirapa. Te apu ko Moiraki te tūrua ka waiwai. Nō reira, e Rāwiri Higgins Takawikoa. Kia ora, members of the panel. Kamihi ki a koe i te wahine toa, o Ngāti Wai. Nau mai, piki mai, kake mai. Haere mai ki roka tēnei, a te takiwā o tāpū o kaitahu whānau. My name is David Higgins, and I reside at Moeraki when I'm not living in Queenstown. I'm an ex a lobster fisherman, and since 1980 I've been the upoko runaka of Moeraki. That status is a status that is given to those of us who have achieved certain notoriety, I guess. And some of that notoriety is directly linked to whakapapa. With my cousins here on the right from Pukataraki and Edward from Otako, who is also an upoko, we are the what you would describe as the titular heads of our communities back home. We have a role that is really interesting in descent from our tupuna, who were also upoko and tohoka, and akatira of our particular kaiks or kainga. I was also part of the team that established these maps, put them all together, and I played a crucial role in shaping and designing the Kahuru Manu cultural mapping program that we were so well supported by our whānau from Kaitahu Whānui I tēnei rohe throughout the island. So it's a pleasure to be here today to represent my tūpuna and also my mukapuna. Nō reira, tēnā koutou katoa.
Katu anō, tēnei mihi atu ki a koutou, ngā karangatanga mā kei mō o tātou. Ko Edward Ellison tuku ingoa, ko Tamate te whare, o tākau tai te awa, te atua o tai ahu, te mauka, ko kaitahu ka te mai mai me waita anō te iwi, ko te hapu o kaitapai, ka te moki, kai te ruahiki. Nō reira, ko tēnei mihi atu, koutou katoa. Edward Ellison, yes, I was in all of the sessions around sending these maps out. And it was really built on the experience we did in Dunedin, began 25 years ago and aborted it because it was being completely misinterpreted within the process, but we rerun it about 10 years later. But we always did think we would do this up here because in reality, this part of Te Wai Pounamu is the cradle, what we call the cradle of our creation stories come from here. The majestic mountains and the lakes seem to conjure up the most majestic stories and, about the creation of this landscape. And so it was absolutely always going to be that we would bring the wahi tupuna mapping approach to the Queenstown Lakes District area. I might just sit down now, if that's all right, and we'll just we'll just proceed. But I'd like to just talk to the statement that was tabled this morning, and talk about that because what we have experienced when we do put our values into a public arena, invariably it appears or runs into a reductionist sort of approach, and that is not the intent of our approach here. We see the whole Queenstown land, lake, mountain area as ancestral land. There are areas we have chosen to map to fit into a planning process that we're giving some particular attention to, but it is not in any way, shape or form meant to indicate that we do not have an interest in those other remaining areas. And in fact, we could have extended our lines quite considerably in many other different directions. You know, I would call the lines on the map that we have applied as soft lines. In a Māori world, the last thing you do is draw lines on a map. If you you don't, if you want to get into trouble, start drawing lines on the map. It's like playing around with whakapapa. And so that is not our intent, and we wanted to make that very clear. So in a broad sense, the context which these maps have been set in are drawn on Māori, the source of life, the source of creation. So we refer to that, we always go back to that as a starting point. Mana, from Māori comes mana, of the land, of the lake, and eventually the stories that are laid on the land, the place names, and the people who trod the land. And then, of course, whakapapa draws us, connects us, so that's a connecting line. And so we say that overlays the whole district. And so the levels of association, so I'm just outlining an item, clause 3, of what we tabled. They are the levels or the layers that we refer to when we talk about connection, talk about place, about history, tradition or custom. So really what I think we're doing here is we've created alert layers, and and the interpretation of effects is something that really we can only give. We've given sufficient, I think, information to give the alert. But in terms of the interpretation and going beyond what's on the maps that you've been given, like I've just described, those wider contexts, that's what we bring into the court. We're not necessarily going to be putting it into your maps straight away. That's something we talk about, that's something we interpret, normally kānohi, face to face. And so I'm just giving a bit of context there, and very importantly, asking that these provisions not be read down. The tenure review process was referred to. I was never personally involved directly, but I was involved in many other roles I've had, because I was never overly happy with the tenure review process and the way that our values were addressed and weighed and assessed and recognised. And my role on Conservation Board, my role on the Conservation Authority previously, I'm there again now, and in my role tribally, many, many discussions around tenure review, and currently it's on hold. Legislation's been framed to withdraw tenure review altogether. Crown retain ownership of the Crown pastoral lands, which Ngāi Tahu support. At least the Crown will hold the land. So I'm just giving you a bit of context to the tenure review. I agree, an archaeology sort of approach. Some of the key people leading the reviews on land were archaeologists, hence. We're focused on those sort of intrinsic, sort of those identifiable values. But also DOC, there was the other context. The tenure review also identified land to be retained by DOC. And we were happy if DOC took land, because many of our values were actually encapsulated in the land that went into the conservation land to be managed by the department. And we have that partnership there, so just giving some context. And then the statutory acknowledgements were only ever to ensure that councils gave a summary of notified consents to Ngāi Tahu, came out of the settlement, because at the time we were not reliably seeing resource consent, notified resource consents. And they were laid. We were given the option of 5 rivers, for example, in the whole of the South Island. We ended up getting 23 or something like that. I can't recall now, but I was directly involved in that. And it was across Crown land. It was never to go across private land, SAs. And so we split them. Just one after, we'd have one miss a lake or a river onto another river, so they spread across the island. And the whole idea was to get some uniformity across the region, and not focus and draw attention to those SAEs particularly. It was meant to apply across the whole region on all waterways. notification.
Kia ora, members of the panel. We've been asked as a pai pai to explain our maps that describe the Wahi Tupuna within this area. Yes. Yes.
Whether as a poem, we should pick up any questions that the panel have about your individual breakdown and then go from there into the panel discussion on various things. Are you happy with that?
Ka pai.
Ka pai. We'll start with Dr. Kapai.
Just how the relationships change over time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So, I guess starting with the idea of how knowledge is created and through experiential practices over time, so intergenerationally. And I guess a good way to put it is that knowledge is like a continuing conversation with each generation, and each generation contributes to that over time. So as new challenges present themselves or new ways of, for example, the landscape has been modified in some way, it's challenged to the whakapapa. It's also challenges to the land use and the access use by mana whenua, or in this case, kaitahu. And as each new challenge presents itself, people will think, how did we had a similar challenge in the past, how did we deal with it then? What does our past tell us about the way that we have shaped our relationship with this particular place, water, mahiga kai, or whatever, over time? And how can that be useful to us now? So our tipuna, for example, have dealt with challenges to these things, changes over time. They've got lessons within their stories, and our stories then continue on those changes in relationships. So the relationships themselves don't change. It's the way they're carried out and the way they're enacted as each new challenge presents itself.
Relationship evolves to cover those.
It's speaking about the Nohoanga, contemporary Nohoanga, right.
Yeah.
And to me, the contemporary Nohoanga are situated within our ancestral landscape, and the specific place the campsite is in isn't necessarily the important thing here. The important thing is that we are able to be located and have access to the mahikakai or whatever the practices were, whatever the values were in that ancestral landscape in those places. And yes, we have a little place where we can camp, and it might have been returned as part like a contemporary campsite, but it's not what's important here. What's important is that it is within the landscapes and we can still practice our values, our tikanga, and our gathering of mahi kai, because most of them were around having access to mahi kai. And I think it was in Edward's evidence where he talked about how we only had 10% of our mahi kai sites left to us following the treaty breaches.
Ms. Carter, were you involved in the Kohoru Manu exercise?
Only at the Puketaraki level. Oh, I'll say only. Yeah, at Runaka level, I guess. Yeah.
I think that's all right.
Dr. Carter, can I just pick up on your discussion with the Commissioner? Because in an earlier stage of this district plan, several panel that was talking about an area of land that was swapped as part of the treaty settlement. This is Sticky Forest, where in lieu of land of the Neg, a group of, I think it was 12, named beneficiaries, or the descendants of 12 named beneficiaries, were given beneficial ownership, not given, but you know, that was part of the settlement, was that they would take ownership of the forest. And that one of the, and it was a massive exercise, I can imagine, you may well be aware of, massive exercise in tracing the beneficiaries after almost 100 years, and the 12, I guess, may not be 12, but it was a small number, have become 1,200 or 1,400, and still counting. But one of the representatives of beneficiaries sought rezoning of the land, in effect to take advantage of an opportunity that was passing by, because the zoning of the land was an issue, and that was Mr. Beresford.
Yep.
And he gave evidence that Sticky Forest was of no cultural significance to him, and he thought his beneficiaries, but he didn't afford to speak for them. He was very clear that he was trying to do something positive for the beneficiaries, but he wasn't their representative. But he told the panel that Sticky Forest was only of significance because of the economic return which it had the potential to generate. If the panel don't find a way to rezone it, it's currently full of trees and mountain bikers. And there are problems because the land is landlocked, and it's now, the zoning is now before the Environment Court. But the specific point to pick up on the Commissioner's question was, I was intrigued by your answer, because as I say, that was not the answer that I previously heard about the placement land, and maybe that's because going from the Neck to Sticky Forest is something quite different to moving, for instance, with Lake Hawea having been raised, moving from what was originally at the Neck up, basically up the slope a bit, but still in the general vicinity. So I invite you to tell me the answer to that
I'm going to defer it to my co-host.
Kia ora. This is a real sticky question. Manuhaya was a 100-acre block of land at the top of the neck at Hawea. It was set aside as a fishing reserve for our ancestors who originated from the Araitiuru coast. All of those families that resided anywhere from the Waitaki River in the north down to Otago in the south had some sort of connection with Manuhaya. Also set aside at the same time as the 100-acre reserve, the fishing easement, was a 1,568-hectare or acre block, which was part of what is now a farm property, on a very steep outcrop as you go across the saddle between the two lakes. That is the land in question. It was landless natives land, so-called landless natives land, and there were named owners, which is really interesting because the land was never allocated. The owners were named, but they weren't allocated. And many of us, our names were not included because we were involved in the 100-acre block down, the fishing easement down at the lakefront. That was the swap. The deal was done with Sticky Forest, and the farmer was able to retain the 1,568 acres up on the hill. The result has been that we are now, I have a list sitting at home of about 1,400 to 1,600 prospective owners, including my grandfather, who's been dead since 1980. And others. There's lots of us that are involved in that whole process, and I think just about every Southern iwi member is listed as a prospective owner, including some of our own children. So there's a lot of work to be done and to try and resolve this issue. In the meantime, Wanaka Township slowly encroaches closer and closer and closer to Sticky Forest. So something's going to have to be done about it sooner rather than later. Kia ora.
I think in my evidence I talk about the names being Waitaki or a reference point to wider catchment areas. So they're not a specific pinpointed space. They give reference to, and I guess also the other thing to remember is that everything interlinks. One name doesn't stand in isolation. So the series of names that I guess, ripple from one area to another, given overall landscape of stories. And landscapes are basically just stories. And each story, once it's known, makes it harder for a landscape to be resisted. And I think what the place names for the Wāhi Tupuna are doing are embedding those stories into the landscape so that they can't be resisted any further, and that our knowledge and our values are going to be there within the landscape itself, but also within the official landscapes and documents that relate to Queenstown Lakes District Council. Does that answer your question? Yes, reference points, markers. So I think the places recall the names. The names recall the whakapapa, the connections, the stories that make up why they're named that. And so within those stories are those reasons, such as was mahika kai, it was another tawhito, it is part of a web of mahika kai places, part of a web of or part of a trail of aratawhito and spots along the way for overnighting or whatever. And so they represent those stories, and they're important. You don't name, when you're talking about stories and you're telling a story, you only have names in there that are particularly important to that story and to those reasons why. There may be other names around it, it's like whakapapa. It's recited in ways that are important to the context. And that's why those place names do that, and as you say, markers within the landscape. Okay, so just on that, looking at where the pākehā names are, in brackets after the kaitahu name, it tends to be a place that already has the pākehā name. And I think it's locating in a general way, in a general area, for people who aren't kaitahu. So for example, Kakamua Hakitakura or Walter Peak and Cecil Peak. So it has pākehā names of Walter Peak and Cecil Peak, but we know it as something different, and it's referring to what the stories, I think, in the evidence, but referring to the twinkling of the light on the snow so that Hakitakura could find her way across the lake. I don't think it would be appropriate to have to do a literal translation of a name if it has no meaning already in an English version. And it may be that there are located in those areas close to which which we have already named, it may be that there are Pākehā names that we could say here's a Pākehā name similar, or not similar, sorry, in the same area. It's located near here, if you want to have a geographical vision of where that place might be. But I don't think it's appropriate, if it hasn't already got a Pākehā name, I don't think it's appropriate to translate it as such, because I think it loses all the meaning. If you don't understand the stories as to how it was named, I think you start to lose the meanings. And you also start to get a very narrow vision of where that place is, because it becomes a spot on the map, and it's not actually a spot on a map. So, yeah, I'm not sure if my mum can add to that, but I guess my summation is just not appropriate to translate names in some instances.
I wonder whether a different way to look at that might be to, that there might be a way to describe those in a way that Rākehā people could, you know, it refers to the western shore of Lake Wānaka, for instance, rather than a specific location. You know, those things might be informative.
Right. I think in the schedule it has descriptions which often have the story of talking about and to the name and how it's how it came about, and that's probably a way that people can have access into understanding those names. Yeah, and then they can look further at the stories themselves and to get more in-depth knowledge. But you're right, it's an educative process, and you know, we try to do what we can to educate people in, I guess, the reasons for those names and who these people were and why their names are actually there in the first place.
So, okay. So to give you another example, I was thinking about Takaroka. You had the words up and down and down.
Right.
So it is much more, it, so arguably that's it, that's much more broader than what you've defined, but it will point a Pākehā reader, where on the map should I go to find this? It's sort of those sort of reference points that I have in mind.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I think we do talk about the English version, the English name around that
Tukuruka
area.
It's also the Hele Whakatau Wainaha. But that was the kind of marker, sort of a memoir that I had.
Oh, okay. Yep, no, that, yeah, I agree. It'd be great to have, and I think Quinton picked up on it too, just having a little explanation about the geographical area so people can sort of have a fair idea where that is exactly, yeah, in terms of their own knowledge for those places. Yeah.
So one of the reasons I want to ask is that when you go through them, I'll ask you for a general description for those that are not already described.
Okay.
That would fit the bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions we have to cover? Now for Mr. Higgins.
Well done.
Just before you start, if you want to ask any questions relating to Kahuru Manu, as one of the instigators, one of the architects of that program, I'm happy to answer, if I can, any questions you have relating to our cultural mapping program.
Lake, is
should be Mokee Lake.
Yes. Should be? Okay. Because you've talked about, and it goes back to this corridor we've already been having this morning, and, you know, values versus maybe pragmatism. You've talked about how you go with your whānau and manu hiri there. Is there any reason that wasn't included or managed as a
You mean up at Mokee Lake? I think most families that live in the Queenstown district sometime during the summer months tend to wind their way up the road to Mokee Lake. it's more of a spiritual journey for my family and myself. My grandparents took me up there in the 1950s. I knew the place reasonably well as a child growing up in this district. Why I say it's possibly a spiritual place is that it's a warming place. And as you'll see with my evidence, I've made the point that Whakatipu Waimauri was a place where our whānau could recuperate from those seasonal activities that they had endured over the previous period. And not only were they happy to settle in, particularly in the in this area here of Tahuna, but they spent time going up to Mokee Lake. One reason was the lake's warm in summer. The coldest lake in the world is this one out here. So summer or winter. So there was a definite migration up to the lake. We didn't include it. I'm not quite sure why we didn't. But we've always known that lake is quite special to us. And of course, it takes you closer and brings you closer to our tūpuna. That's why we look at high mountains, because the higher up the mountain you are, the closer you are to our tūpuna. So I think Edward and I were talking this morning about the likes of Mokee Lake and where the possible name Punatapu comes from. And we suspect there's a spring up there somewhere that feeds that lake and other little lakes on the water's journey down to Whakatipu Waimauri. So that's for our next generation to discover.
So it's an ongoing process of reconnecting with them and recalling and rediscovering their story, much like.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. I think I described in my evidence that my only daughter was married up here on the top of the hill at Cecil Peak. Whilst we were there, the wedding party were more interested in my story of Haki Takura than they were in actually the marriage ceremony that was meant to be taking place. So that's the importance, the rekindling of those connections with these areas up here.
Are there many Manawhenua living here?
Yes, we're very fortunate to have two sitting behind us today, two tautoko us, and there are a number of Manawhenua living here. There's particularly a group of Edward's relations over on Calvin Heights. They're all fishermen from Awarua, who delight in having holiday homes up here. And they've become quite part of the community. They just don't use these as holiday homes. They actually live here. So there are a number of our whānau who now reside back here in Tahuna. To many of our families, we who have come up here for many generations, and as I've said, I came up here when I was about, I won't tell you how old, but back in the 1950s, I've encouraged my children and their children to actually not only invest in homes up here, but to live here and experience life in this this part of the world. Some of the activities that we have conducted in the past generations, we continue to do so today. And I share those with my children when they're back here in New Zealand. Whether it's walking the Greenstone Valley or up the top of the Awa Whakatipu, we will go up there and enjoy the landscape and talk about those ancestors that walked those lands previously. It's an interesting question to ask somebody like me. I was a member of the Ngāi Tahu Māori Trust Board when we prosecuted the claim before the Waitangi Tribunal. And I gave substantial evidence to the tribunal over a number of years. And some of that evidence, along with my cousins, is recorded as part of history of this country. One of the reasons why we set up Kahuru Manu was because we didn't have the resources, the funding, the technical ability to actually do what we've done with Kahuru Manu today, back in the day in the 1980s when we prosecuted the claim. And we did a disservice to our Tupuna, to our ancestors, because we didn't complete the task as we would today. The result was that a number of our kaumātua, who are much older than me, were passing on, and we required to get as much of that information and evidence from them as we could before they did pass on. So we started the cultural mapping project exactly for that reason, so that we could ensure that we would have for future generations the mātauraka, the traditions, the histories, and the knowledge that was handed down from our ancestors, not only in paper form, but as part of Kahuru Manu. So we've done that, and we've done it to the best of our ability, given the technical abilities we have today. There is a huge opportunity. I've got to say this. What you guys have seen on Kahuru Manu when you look it up on the website is only a third of the names. The tapu names, the names that are held by a particular runaka, are separate from what you're seeing there. Those names are kept in a, I wouldn't say a locked file, but they're kept separate because those landscapes, those names, and the references to those names come from family manuscripts, which are held by members of our families, and they're sacrosanct. So we have the ability here in Queenstown Lakes District, we have the ability from our three runaka on the Otago coast and those further south to be able to tap into some of those tapu names if we need to, with the permission of those particular runaka in the future. So there's a huge opportunity. I hope I've answered some of your question as to how we can best share those particular place names.
It sort of leads on to my next question, actually, because the, it has been implied a number of times there are certain values that are secret, and then you touched on that just now, and versus ones that are, I suppose, common knowledge or well documented. Can you give me an example of the type of value that you would hold secret as opposed to one that is
Not necessarily secret, but sacred. A good example is the pa site up at the Dart. There's a particular Mamoi pa site at the Dart River, overlooked by Arei, the mountain. And that pa site is not just a postage stamp on an envelope. It's the whole envelope. And for us, sharing the knowledge that the pa site still exists there today is one issue. But the fact that there are wahi tapu and wahi tauka dotted all around that pa site are what are kept as secret files or sacred files. And that's where our tuahu are, that's where our treasures are buried, and that's where our tūpuna are buried. So that's the importance of those so-called sacred sites. Both. It's both. Yeah, both.
In your evidence, you talk about sitting atop Queenstown Hill or Kelvin Heights, and I found it interesting you chose those examples because they represent probably the highest development outlooks in the district tonight. But you also talk about how you use those as examples of the stories behind the landscape that they represent. So I just wondered, given that they represent most of the threats that you've identified in the other Waikiki Tapuna areas, does the existence of development in those views compromise the stories which you tell?
No, not so much compromise, because we can only look through the eyes of our ancestors. And if you could imagine standing there 150, 200 years ago and looking at that landscape, there are particular parts of the landscape that you identify directly. And they are our moka, they are our awa, they are the roto itself. in relation to, how can I say, those particular places where you can stand and look at the landscape, we can only do it through the eyes of our old people who are no longer with us, and we can only imagine what the place would have looked like back in their day. I think it's very much an intangible. We have to use our imagination.
And so I suppose it follows that there are types of activities that do compromise the ability to read the landscape, and there are others, for example, a dam, for instance, might make it hard to describe a journey along a river. suppose, yeah, as we move through this, I'll be interested to understand how the threats or the activities which are covered under this rule affect the values which have been identified. And that's, I'll probably just leave it at that, but that's an interesting discussion for us.
It is a very interesting discussion. Because I come from the Waitaki area, there's a good example that's used by a number of my whānau and our relations in the Waitaki Valley. A lot of our whānau believe that the Māori of our rivers, our sacred rivers of the Waitaki Valley, are managed by a guy sitting in Takapō B power station with his finger on the red button. And you think about it, you know, he's got control over the flow. He's got control over what happens with that water and what happens with the roto that the water is going to be finally entering. So we don't all carry that view, but it's an interesting view, isn't it, that it's as simple as it could get. Yes, kia ora, kia ora.
I think it's worse. I think it's probably managed from Wellington.
Probably.
There are about, latest count I saw was 57,000 total Ngaitahu registered. There are many more registering every day. Of those seven Rūnaka, I would guess if there are 18 Papatipu Rūnanga within Ngaitahu, I'd say just go half. I've no idea, to be honest. Our own Rūnanga have over 10,000. Our own Otako, well, you know, so
12.
Yeah.
We got 13.
Yeah, so it's, see, so many of them will be have a right in 1, 2, 3, or 4.
Mm.
If you understand what I'm saying, people multiple.
Are they double counted?
Not in the tribal register, no.
No.
But David might be in 3, 4, 5.
Yeah.
Really,
mm-hmm.
You know. Yes. Yep.
And I'll just going back to the pathway that I asked Mr. Higgins around that contemporary practice of mana whenua, ahika, those types of practices and relationships. Besides, I guess, reconnecting and residing in this place and coming to this place and walking the trails and telling the stories, is it this process? Is it this engaging in this process and getting these values and kōrero met? Is that part of that?
It is a part. It's only a part. Really, what has happened over since the treaty was signed and the land sales were made, now people were confined into their very small reserves. And if they couldn't survive there, they moved out to work. And really, it was those people who remained engaged with the Ngaitahu kaupapa who carried forward all of these values, principally through the clan, generations. And the most effort and the most time was put into the claim, generations of effort. And that's what kept a lot of the kōrero alive. They couldn't access these places. Landowners wouldn't let them on. or they were poisoning the rabbits and killed all the mahingakai, or draining the rivers or lakes and wetlands. Really, in the 1800s, they were starving, and they couldn't access their traditional grounds. So this is what's driving this, really. We have a duty to do this, not only to put these things right, but also to carry forward for future generations this identity, connection, history, so that they can, in their time and in their generations, see with integrity the landscape as our ancestors saw it. So post-settlement, of course, we've got some resources to do some, and this is why we're doing this. We're actually now got some resources and time and people who can help us carry this forward into the district plans. My first meeting with the Queenstown District Council was in 1995, and probably the most senior elderly councillor told it me, it was a whole rupu, Maori were never in here. So it's just turning back those things. So the people, our people who live out in these regions may or may not be connected what we're doing back on our marae, but the heart and soul of our effort comes from the marae.
Got it.
Our company, which is now known as OCA, we were the first to do cultural impact assessments in the country. So I'm well aware of them and the benefit of them, and we generally applied them to major projects because they could be quite complex. It's not easy to reduce something down to say, well, this is what the effects are, might be on these values. And we found that very valuable as have clients. And I think one of our planners has provided a paper on the types of cultural impact assessments we've done. Mm-hmm. And I believe they're very valuable for all parties. Yes, so we've done many across Otago. Hokanui Renaka is associated with the Hokanui Hills near Gore.
Yes, and which of course prompted me. yes, right. given that I think traditionally the boundary between Otago and South, at least for rugby purposes, how is Hokanui are associated with the Otago coastal Renaka and not with those from coastal south? I'm just exploring my own personal curiosity now.
Well, Hokanui, the people who asked for Hokanui to be recognised as a Renaka were from Whakapapa, from the South Otago area, principally, and Otago. But also further south, probably really coming out of Tuawaiki, who was one of the senior chiefs of Ngāi Tahu, in his area was that area, around the mouth of the Clutha, south. So it was quite, and that was agreed in 1993. How the people there associate to that whakapapa now, I couldn't totally answer for them. I'm not going to. But that was the nature of the formation of Hokanui Runaka. They could have easily have placed the centre of that in Valclutha or Kaitangata or Kakapoi, you know.
It's really important for the panel to understand that Murihiku starts at the Waitaki River and goes south. So Murihiku ki te ra, that's us. Get down to the Clutha, the Mataau, Murihiku ki te toka, are those other Runaka down to Colac Bay. So we're all one big whānau of the seven Runaka.
Yeah.
You got it.
We would never say that.
And I think that might answer my second question already, but I'll ask it anyway. The administrative arrangements are separated into Akaha and Tānu. Some of the submitters asked the question about going back to Waitakere. There are geographical divisions of interest for different Manaaka, for different parts of this district, or is it basically all of the Manaaka are interested in all of the district, or something like that?
How long have you got? It's a good question. And look, what we did in Otago was set up Okaha, or its forerunner, principally to both assist Runaka, but also councils and clients in terms of process these RMA things, principally. Te Ao Marama did the same. And so they serve their masters in the terms of those two entities, the Runaka. The Runaka were under the Trant Act, Takiwa. And those takiwā may define a coastal boundary, but they don't define an interior boundary. So it becomes, the further inland you travel, the more shared the interest becomes. But at the end of the day, Te Ao Marama, Okaha, and the Runaka, when they're dealing with the Pacific thing, they do need to be aware of whakapapa. Because that is the start and finish of the interests, where the authority lies. And we use these other tools to try and address 90% of the issues, but there'll be a component that relies on the people dealing with those matters to understand the whakapapa connection. Mm. And that's a study in itself, to be fair, knowing those rights, because you have iwi, such as Waitaha connections, a Kati Māmui, and then the Kaitahu iwi as well. So there's a whole amalgam of marriages, and the mana often stems to those early marriages. The people come in, they would always take a wife from the Waitaha, give the mana to the land, particularly to their children. So it's a study in its own, and you generally do not get these dealt with through a consenting process. The arguments might be head back on the marae, but for the intents of making the process work, the papatipu runanga are there, Te Ao Marama serve, and Te Okaha serve a good function. I think by and large it's worked pretty well for the 20 odd years that they've been going, but in the back of our minds, whakapapa. If the process is not done in mind of that, then there's a flaw in our view. Yeah. Does that answer you?
Thank you. The next more general question.
Chapter 5 of the district plan has a translational explanation of Wayne Tupuna, and I wrote it down as landscapes and places that embody the relationship of Kaitahu and their culture and traditions with their ancestral lands, water sites, Waitahu and other Tonga. It refers to places that hold the respect of the people in accordance with Te Kanga. Are we getting the right lines? Are we looking at the right thing? Would you have a different definition?
I'm not totally sure where that definition came from. I might want to read it.
Pass it the book.
Generally, it gives a description that can be interpreted, I suppose, a number of ways. But overall, I presume it came from Okaho, I don't know.
Well, so do I. I presume that as well.
Yes.
I sat on that here, and I can't recall. I don't imagine that LDC planners came up with it themselves.
No, you're right.
And lastly, an issue about the schedule, not so much what's in it, but the relationship between the concepts. That we've got a column that says values, and then another column. You've inserted, I don't think it's in the right version, right? A description of sites included. And I wonder whether the labels, it's true to labels. But can I say, first of all, that the additional material you provide on the description is very helpful. But I wondered if you're not actually describing sites included, but you're also, well, that's not just what you're doing, but you're also clarifying and fleshing out how the values apply in that area. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the description of sites included, it's not, I think you're right, some of them are values, but you know, we could do more work on that, perhaps.
But they're not so much. I'm not going to get hung up about labels, but I'm really trying to get at, when you set out to do this, were you trying to clarify how those values apply to each project?
Generally, that's right. Yes.
Can I clarify a question that I was going to ask? Did you have in your mind the list of values that were already for each of those sites to try and flesh them out?
I think that was the approach, yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Because the reason that I'm concerned about is that the policies just refer to the values. So they talk about adverse effects on the values what I'm wondering is whether those two columns could somehow be labelled so that they could be looked at together, so that one's an elaboration or description of the values, because that I think helps an applicant or some people at council when considering whether there are adverse effects on the values.
It's not a bad idea.
Does that work in terms of the way you looked at it?
It does, on the questioning, and then me looking at it, I can see that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Because why it's very helpful.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, thanks.
So the linking of the values and that description could be brought together.
Agreed.
So that then the policies can be applied across all that information.
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. tribute to the identified way in a being significant. And I just want to explore whether you had that in your mind when you were doing the mapping. Because I know you, I mean, it's very, very clear the whole district is important, it's ancestral land, and it's effectively significant. But in being pragmatic, you've brought that down to these Wahitukuna areas and you've identified some values within them. So are those Wahitukuna, could we say in terms of that policy anyway, that the mapping and the values associated with them are what makes those Wahitukuna particularly significant?
I think so, Commissioner. I when you read the RPS, I see some issues there. Need some rewording.
We can't do
that. Oh. there's.
There is a level of significance being applied in terms of whipping down without going too far the value, the mapping and the associated values will not quite need to.
I think so.
Randomly picked them,
yes. Well, absolutely, we did. That's been a specific outcome of that exercise. That's right. I think you're right. I might have to confer, and we can reply on that. Perhaps it's
you're right.
It would just be good to
get
confirmation that it sort of links in even if it's not perfectly
yes.
with the wording in the RPS.
Thank you. Yeah, helpful.
In one of the rules that Earthworks rule, I think it is, relating to, suggested from Mr. Barker, relating to the 400 metres of upsea, there's a few Wahitukuna that have been singled out where, no matter what the area of the part of upsea they've obviously got some particular significance. Why have those Wahitukuna been chosen to have
with these rules apply regardless of their elevation. Have you been involved in, if you haven't been involved, say. I have, but there's 43 of them, and Puna Tapu's one. Yes. We chose five that we believe there's particular tapu associated, and you've named four of them, I think, there, Commissioner. They are all quite significant landscape from a cultural view, through a cultural lens.
Yeah.
And particularly want to protect those. They do, yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
Go.
Ready to go. I think we're ready to talk about Wahitukuna number one. Okay. Can you pull up, please, that we're focusing on the end of the northwest end of Lake Harvey. You got to keep going. Come to the left now. Pull down a little. Don't go the other way. Hopefully, right. Come out a little so we can see the whole site. And get rid of the box.
Cool.
Right. See, can you blow it up? Fractionally? Just a little. That's as good as can you see it?
Kia ora. Kia ora. This is the first area of concern for us, and we've discussed the neck, Manu Haya or Manu Whaia, and also the Hunter Valley 1,568 hectares or acres just to the north of Manu Whaia. So if you have a look at the map, you'll see the saddle, the road to Makarora goes over the saddle. Just up on to the right or north of the main road is that particular landless natives block that was exchanged for sticky forest. So that just gives you a context of what we're talking about.
So that's the area on the north side of
The neck. Yes. Very steep land there. I couldn't imagine a mountain goat living up there. But there is an airstrip right up on top that Cochrane's had when they were working that side of the farm. But this is just part of Hunter Valley, the property, now owned by overseas interests. So the old Mamoi, or previously the Waitaha Pa site, is on the southern side of the saddle road, Oroko Te Whatu, the place of Te Whatu, Oroko Te Whatu. Oroko Te Whatu was a Waitaha chief who lived in this area, lived right up there on the saddle, and that pa site has been set aside as a reserve under the auspices of the Department of Conservation at present. But we have an involvement as Mana Whenua in developing that pa site if we wish to in the future. So if you look at that particular site where Manu Fire is, or where it was prior to the flooding of the lake for hydro generation, it's very obvious to us all that Manu Fire itself was a particular fishing easement for the purposes of sustaining our people that lived up at Oroko Te Whatu. The other interesting part of this this pa site, the old Waitaha pa site, is that you can see right across to the other side of Lake Hawea. And it's really important that you can see right across to the other side, because that was where the whānau travelled from the Ahuriri and came right over from the Waitaki Valley over the old trails and ended up in this particular area, which is now described as Dingleburn. Ka pai?
If I might add, my introduction to this area was in the 50s, around the time it was being dammed, I think it was, because what happened while I've never seen the old traditional Ealing lagoon and what have you, because the lake was raised by the time I saw it, but what happened at the time in 1960, the Crown, without talking to our people, compensated us apparently with £40 and then spent it doing something to investigate the site. And then eventually in 1970 they paid $135 for 75 acres. And both David and I were part of that. My father was the person who I've learnt a lot of.
Mm.
He was involved in the corridor that went on around these incidents, informed us about this place, and what was there, and what was lost, and what was done by the Crown. Not what we saw, but it was through the corridor back at home or in the marae. And so that's how we know so much about what this meant to our people. So I was the treasurer of the Otago Māori Executive, and when I was treasurer, we had this specific account, because when they received the cheque, they banked it, and that caused the transaction then to become valid. They didn't know that at the time. And so it's still sitting in the bank, and we weren't to touch it.
And we're the trustees.
We are now the trustees. But so this is a wee bit of how the stories carry. It's not by us going and doing what our ancestors did, because you cannot. Those places are gone and they're flooded, but we're still attached and we're connected and we know about it. And it's important that we carry this forward so that our future generations understand these things. So, yeah, so we went up there before the Haast Road was continued up past Haast Road, and Father would actually talk about these things.
The question I have, and I think that this is probably a question that's common. I understood, I knew a little bit of background, I've learned more through this process. The story about 40 pounds giving and then taking it back for legal expenses is in the Glendine CIA.
Mm-hmm.
You're thinking, yeah, right. The question more generally is, you sat in a room, how many of you were there, by the way, that contributed to the exercise?
No more than half a dozen at a time, and that included our planners.
We're there to observe and keep you on task.
That's great.
The question I had is, you've got a story that is focused on what is now flooded. You've got a saddle. I can easily understand the significance of the saddle. It's a unique landmark, even to a Pākehā eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the pass up south, you've got the area that was swapped to the north. How did you draw the lines around? How far did you go, and on what basis did you push the lines where you put them? Just to take this as an example, because that, of course, is the question that the spinners are all asking. They're not actually asking it about this one, but because this is number one, I'll pose a question. You can just talk me through your thinking process about why you put the lines where you did, given that background about the significance of the site.
In this example, we imagine we're there in the way it used to be, in that we would see from that site the nohoanga, or the hunting gathering place for tuna, which it was, in the areas that they would have accessed besides catching tuna, going and catching bird, weka, and other commodities, that they would require a bit of landscape. And that would be something they would see every day. It was something they would have in their memory when they were back on the coast. That's what they would carry with them, that visual sense of that area, that location. And you know, we are thinking in terms of these are the people who have rangatira, tanga, over that place. So it reflects that connection, that status. They are the people with the right. And so is that scale.
So summarising what you're saying is, you pictured yourself standing on dry land, perhaps at the lake side of the lagoon, to look up and say, what would you see?
Mm.
And draw around the roof line.
Yes, we did. And it's also, David was talking about that 1,600 acres up on the that was had a checkered career as well, so it needed to include that sort of scale as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yes.
It's own right being a
I think if you had a topographical map in front of you, you would see the toto, the blood. And the blood flows from those moka, and they come down the creeks. And the area has, as Edward has described, we looked at the area, our people were hunters and gatherers. They would have gone up those creeks. As steep as they would have been, they would have gone right up Sawyerburn and those other creeks, searching for resources. Not all the resources were in the around the lake. Some of the resources were in those, what we call the toto, or the blood of our worker. So as you can see, the line has been drawn carefully. You can understand the line around the lakefront, but when you get up into the high areas around Sentinel Peak, you can actually see where those creeks have formed and flow back down into the wetlands around Kids Bush and Bushy Point, as well as right up to Manuhaya.
Yeah, no, that could be quite easily, yeah, that's right.
Sentinel.
Yes.
And equally, in a number of other cases, you've identified activities on the slopes and ridges as a threat, and this is one of the more elevated and higher altitude ones, but you haven't identified ridges and higher slopes.
Possibly. We've included in this mapping project here for this example in Area 1, Isthmus Peak in the south and Sentinel Peak in the north. More is actually Sentinels. More is Po. To indicate the importance to us of those particular peaks and the significance of the height of the peaks. And as I referred to earlier, the fact that you're closer to Aotearoa, the higher you climb. And it may be something we've missed, but perhaps one of my cousins can have a better explanation than that.
Sure, the mountains in those cases, though, they certainly accessing may not have been a huge thing for them. From that Manuhaya site, they would have most likely gone up to Makarore area where there's Ponamu and other sources up there. So their focus wouldn't be so much in climbing the mountains. I don't think that's the feature for us there. That would draw them there, and from where they would go from there, there would be other places they would most likely go to. I have no issue with the visual and taking in that, because I'm saying that's the vista that they would have from that location, and that would be the memory of that place. They would know the names. They would talk about them.
Is it more the broad scale?
Yes, you have. I don't think our people, if the they valued a place, it wasn't just a small patch.
No.
They had scale. And they could have scale because they are the only people there. I think that's another.
Picking up on that and what Commissioner Dawson was talking about earlier, the names as reference points, so those maunga and other names within that catchment are referenced to and referenced by Manu Whaia, so they become
that
whole,
that's right.
The whole importance of that whole area is known then, and not just one small place on the map. So it's about connecting those, the knowledge of all those places and how they're significant in supporting the different areas, the different mahikai sites, etc., through that whole catchment. So I think Commissioner Chetham talked about catchment wide, and I guess that's a good example of what we talked about earlier.
Very well, yeah. Yep.
So, you know, I think, anyway, we just need to.
Well, should we go on to area two?
Bye-bye.
As I say, I'm actually making it faster.
Speed up.
Do it this way. Yeah, this is southern end of Lake Hawea, and the design of the wahi tupuna here was really to capture those parts of the lake or the lake edges where our people would have their seasonal camps. One was at the bottom of Timaru Creek, Timaru River on this map, and down in the Tawaha or Hawea, near the mouth of Lake Hawea was also a well-known seasonal camp, and so people would frequent this particular lake for their seasonal work, mahingakai, hunter and gathering activity. Interestingly, we left the middle part there with the township out. I'm not sure that they utilised that part of the lake edge hugely, or on those sheltered sides on either side of the lake. Yeah, quite popular and common in our traditional stories about Lake Hawea and the people associated with that lake, both from Te Araituru coast principally.
It's really interesting. We've got an operative Nohoka site just there at the you can see the little dot there just as you enter the village of Lake Hawea itself. It's one of the most popular Nohoka sites that we have within the tribal Rohi. It's amazing the number of people that visit that site, and for various reasons, but one of the reasons they go there, of course, is to reconnect with their with a place their ancestors walked. Timaru Creek, as Edward has described, is a very important aratawhito, which takes you out of the valley and over towards the Lindis. So it's just another route that our people would have used at certain times of the year. One of the interesting things about these aratawhito, and I appreciate that one of the commissioners mentioned earlier, the fact that we have those Commissioner Robinson mentioned, we have all these trails all across, dotted all across the Te Waka o Aoraki. Never did our people travel on the same route over and come back the same way. They always came back a different route altogether, which is really interesting. But that was the way they preserved and sustained the Mahika Kai on those particular trails.
Yeah, one of my tasks back in the day of settlement was looking for Nohowanga, and it was went out with Lynn's people really to identify close as we could to traditional sites. And in this case, we were reasonably fortunate to get quite close.
Yeah.
Not all Crown land is necessarily suitable. Well, there's besides Timaru Creek, there is actually settlement Nohowanga back toward Gladstone on that side of the lake. There were several settlements along seasonal campsites around Lake Hawea. So Kokotani would be one of them. Just have to check that actually, but I think that's right.
I think you're right. Yeah. Same area.
Generally in that same area.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yep. It's John's Creek, yeah.
Similar approach, really. It was to give an appropriate breadth and width, scale, because we are talking about wahi tūpuna. So we weren't going to be diminishing that sort of approach. And it's always mindful of what the people, the ancestors, would have seen and associated with. So besides hunting and gathering in that general vicinity, they will have travelled outside of those areas as well, of course. But it's just location in what they would have seen and associated with. Travel corridor is probably quite flooded. Further north you go on that western side, I mean the actual corridor that they utilised. So we weren't trying to capture that so much. But it was really just a buffer around what we see as a seasonal campsite and something that they would have comfort with. It's their comfort zone, really. So it is a visual association, accessibility stuff with those particular seasonal campsites. But we did run into a bit of an issue with the track along the lake on the western side, as I've mentioned. As you know, it's well and truly under the lake.
Right. Yep.
In the case of the Mahomas around rivers, you haven't applied a buffer, you know, a buffer of, in some places, kilometres or more, as you have in the case of Pauwhinga. So I'm just wondering, are you looking, standing on the side and saying, what's the visual catchment, or are you trying to create a buffer around what the interest of hunting might be, or I'm not quite sure what you're trying to protect?
I don't know that it's so much visual, but it's certainly capturing the association in what those ancestors would have appreciated of that particular location, either side of that lake. So, I mean, you know, as I've mentioned earlier, the whole district is ancestral land, but we've endeavoured in these wahi tupuna to gather what we think would be a reasonable parameter around where those key sites, seasonal campsites were. And, you know, it wasn't, as with the previous discussions, so much in this case looking at the mountaintops.
So if we're to take Timaru Creek, for instance, you know, and a buffer around that, you know, if you've taken Breast Hill or Breast Peak, which, you know, and the visual catchments of that, but you haven't taken Corner Peak and the visual catchments of that, or that, I don't understand.
Well, you know, how far, you know, we could have extended or whatever, but this is the facing area of those settlements, the faces they would have been familiar with. While they will have spent a lot of time in those particular localities, they will have gone out beyond these boundaries, of course, hunter and gathering. But it was for the purpose of these particular areas being important, well known in our archives, in our traditions, at Lake Hawea, in these seasonal campsites were frequented. So what I'm saying is we think the cultural association, that ancestral association with this particular land scape can be captured like we have here appropriately. Recognises, gives sufficient weight to the fact that the people were lived there, camped there, seasonally went there from a long distance, travelled huge distances to be there.
Am I to take from that the faces of Breast Hill were of more important cultural value than the faces of Corner Peak and Eagle Peak?
It's more, I don't know that you could say that. Really, it's just that, I mean, honestly, the Timaru Creek was quite a well-known track. We could have easily run it up there.
But you haven't mapped that?
No. We haven't mapped everything, what we're saying.
Spaces of Breast Peak are
think we probably need to be clear, this doesn't define the general hunting range of the people who are living camping at these sites. They went, obviously, probably go for days and go and camp out in some instances, perhaps to get some taramea or something else. So they would have gone on excursions, or parties of them would have gone. So we're not trying to capture the hunting range. But we are mindful that this would be a close hunting range, something quite important and probably need to understand. In the heart of this, we've got the lake. So this is at boundaries of the lake. The lake's very important because it's got ancestral connotations as well. So take the landscape with the lake as well. They go together. That is a good question, and I'm only going off memory because I was directly involved in the negotiations on this.
Now, I'm sure you remember what happened 30 years ago.
But from my memory, it was clear, of course, all the Crown King that remained on Crown land title. And so, as far as I understand, therefore, you've got the marginal strip, or whatever they call it, the riparian Lynn's, now Lynn's, I forget who it was back then, but I think it includes anything that's Crown, as far as I can remember. Water, of course, and then the marginal strip's not that wide, but Commissioner, you're talking about the operation level, which is different here in Lake Hawea, of course, which...
But that was the principle.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Basically, stop where at the wet bit and go up to the edge of the Crown land,
yes.
Wherever that was.
Yes. Yeah. Most definitely not go on private land.
Sorry, Commissioner. Any more questions on site two?
The weak kink.
Yeah, the weak
kink. Dog leg. So, can you see the? Can you see the sort of the property boundary at the bottom end of where the kink actually goes through?
Yeah.
The person who owned that came to talk to us, and I mean, she was struggling to understand that particular boundary, and I know there's no exact science. But I guess my question is that the sort of thing that you could continue to look at?
given, I mean, I'm not saying you should do that for every location or every site or just because someone comes along, but it does seem that that's a little bit of an anomaly, that that kink happens to be there, but her boundary also has a kink, which isn't the same kink.
Yeah, no, I agree. Quite happy to have a look at that.
Just for clarity, we did discuss the kink, this one, yesterday, and my instructions are that the submitter would consent to amend that line to conform with how it, you know, aligns. Basically, cut up a kink area.
Like,
so,
yes, you can see the line.
The curved line.
Now, she was suggesting just go straight down to the corner of the road.
I suppose we need to get this on a map,
yeah.
But basically there is a goodwill to remove that anomaly.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much
for being there. Well,
no, I don't.
No, I'm going to write the same topic again.
Well thought. Going to the third one, which is actually site 2A.
So sorry, is the issue with the top end of the...
Just see how the western end of the town in the zone
yeah.
flipped
yeah.
by a slice of Waikato Puna. And
yeah,
it's not clear whether that's the
farmer
2 swinging around there or whether it's
part of
site number
3. Yeah, well, it could be the same as the previous discussion. Same issue as the previous discussion,
yes.
Is it? Yeah.
We'll get another kink.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, you've talked about the fact that there was a seasonal camping area.
Yes.
Yeah. What was the outlet of the lake in
yeah.
that area?
I think that was on the other side, south of the camping ground, wasn't it?
Yep.
So I suppose, well, whether it's in site 2 or site 2A, can you explain the rationale as to why? In terms of mapping the Waikato Puna area,
yeah.
Oh, I see. You can see it now. There.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
South of that, it's much flatter into the, what's now, is it the Timsfield subdivision?
Mm.
Yeah, I just wonder if that's the intended outcome there.
I doubt if it is.
It's not on here, it doesn't.
Can we take that over lunch? I can take instructions.
Yeah.
Because we're working on a slightly different.
Understand. Any other questions? How are you?
just one. You haven't mapped the Butterfield wetlands, and I can imagine that
Then we don't know what goes. Not mapped, but it's definitely a Nohaka site there, right in the horseshoe. It's non-operative at present, but it sits right slap bang on the on that horseshoe.
On the western side.
Yeah,
side.
The western side.
So in the horseshoe, not
yeah.
On the outside.
Yeah.
Okay, so
yeah.
I'm talking about the horseshoe there, the middle of it, as we would call it in Australia. Oxbow Lake that exists on the outside, is that not?
On the outside of the horseshoe?
Yeah.
I see. Hang on.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the,
yep.
The placement. So had a good look around there when we were doing the Notwanga. And highly modified. But so we chose...
Highly modified?
Yes, yeah, so parts of that area they have been quarried or... what have you, so, yeah, so,
I'm not sure we're talking about the same spot, if that's the case, but...
Yeah, it's while it's...
Well, I suppose ultimately we don't have scope to...
That's right,
no.
Of interest anyway,
yeah.
So
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we're on to site number 4, Brisbane number 3.
Yeah.
So there is a mismatch between the two, but that's by the one.
This site is Turihuka. It was a really important traditional settlement here, a campsite of some substance. This was basically the area where our whānau came down the Dingle from the Ahuriri and settled on the far site on the peninsula here, or perhaps more towards the airstrip, and actually moved from Turihuka over to Manuhaya on a regular basis. So this was the stop-off point when they arrived. Our people arrived from Ahuriri in the Waitaki Valley and arrived at Lake Hāwea. Some of them would go the inland route down to the Timaru Creek, but more generally this was the old pass site. There are a lot of well-known archaeological sites on this particular area here as part of Dingleburn. So that was the importance of this particular site in this map.
Does Silver Island hold any particular value?
As far as I know, I'm not aware, because Silver Island would have been obviously
a
bit bigger, and it could have been a peninsula. Yes, I suspect that it could have been part of the delta. Yeah, you've got to imagine that this lake has been. Modified.
Just to hear you've mentioned archaeological sites, but that's not a value that's listed here for protection.
No. We're aware of a number of archaeological sites on this area, and they could be as simple as middens, as opposed to anything of real significance. But I think when you look at the area where the buildings are and the airstrip, perhaps that area could have been a substantial Mahikakai area. I suspect it would have been. It's near the delta of the river. Other than that, that's mainly the site was used for residential purposes.
And you don't appear to have taken the approach that you've taken at Hāwea or Timaru Creek and sort of
Yeah, we haven't. I suspect that we didn't have to travel too far up that valley. We would have come down the river anyway on arrival at this particular pass site, but I couldn't imagine that we would have to go any further inland to hunt when probably all of that area was rich in manu and kaimanu and kairoto. Yep.
Off the campsite, and that if you were to apply the approach you've taken on the further south on the edge of Pawea or even at the campground at Pawea, I don't understand why those spaces aren't mapped.
Yeah, not sure myself, but I suspect that a lot of that area would have been dry anyway. Because we're not looking at similar maps, it's just a wee bit confusing. But I suspect that all that area inside Silver Island would have been quite dry, and I'm not sure why we didn't go any further down that southern edge.
There's two significant catchments, I suppose, that flow.
Yep. Not sure why we did that. Tūrua tūpapaku.
One thing we haven't discussed much along the way is the sort of description, the European descriptions of these locations, or whether there's any offer of those in these cases.
Yeah, like SA, rather than do it on the fly, I think we might just ask from our team to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's further south, I think. No, it's that area. No, it's that area. You can actually
see it. It's sort of that small pink
area. See the bridge?
Yep.
Mm.
See
how there's a double layer
there? Oh, this is one. Is this the one where there's the gap? I know that. Well, while we're there, there's like a hole in the Tapuna. You see the horseshoe rod at the top?
Yep.
Yep.
Yes. Thank you. That one. Any reason why that's not included, other than somebody was instructed to have a path around the river? And
no, the driver for this one really is the name, Tūpapaku, which is refers to a corpse, I suppose, or a burial place where, and there's quite a lot of, I don't believe there's any archaeological work being done in the area, but we just want to be sure that that area is marked and protected until we such time as we have a better idea of how to look after that site.
We could have gone further up the river, as you've suggested, and gone up to that horseshoe at the top, the Wiggly Tuna, but as Edward has explained, at the request of the Lugget community, we were invited to share with the community some traditional knowledge of the area, and we stuck strictly to that part of the river where there was perhaps a known Urupa / pa site on one of those corners. We didn't expand any further because I think there's still a lot of work to be done on this particular part of the river.
Understand? Any questions?
Is it, you referred
there was a partial fortified power at the end of Church and Shortcut Road. So the power was down there. How well fortified it was, we're not sure. We suspect it was a Māmoe pā, not a tahu pā. And that's as far as we've got so far. But I think we need to get some archaeologists in there to have a decent look around.
I imagine that obviously there's quite a history of gold mining and
yes,
dairy
yeah.
crossings and industrialised sort of
yep.
European history as well.
So
right where the bridge is there.
Basically, the power was there, the same way as the bridge is there.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
We'll come to that too. That's a good point.
Yes.
Why some of these places are where they are, such as Queenstown or Wanaka. But the Hori Kere Tairo in 1879, 1880, he went around interviewing Kaumātua of the day, and this is one of the places that some interesting dialogue comes out of, which causes us to be have an heightened interest in this area.
So, that ingoa wāhi te rua to Papaku, is that an ingoa that your team gave to this wāhi tūpuna, or it's always been called that?
Traditional name.
It is a traditional name,
yeah.
Okay. Well, that gives it almost a deep,
yes.
deep giveaway.
Yeah.
Well, I'm hoping that at the time, at 25 past 12, so we'll adjourn. We'll be back at 1:15.
Kia ora, thank you.